Our next case is AFGE Local 3438 versus Social Security Administration 2021-1972. Mr. Harris, please begin.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Your Honors, the arbitrator in this case inappropriately denied attorney fees contrary to the Back Pay Act. We are respectfully asking that this court rule that the fees are warranted in the interest of justice, return the matter to the arbitrator for determination on the appropriate amount of fees which are due.
Mr. Harris, could we please first talk about this court's Reed decision, which seems to plainly require us to dismiss your appeal because you and your union does not have a right to appeal this decision by the arbitrator?
We would disagree that Reed stands for that position. Reed had nothing to do with attorney fees. Reed had to do with an MSPB denial. It was not an arbitration. The union did not allege any injury to itself whatsoever in that case.
Didn't Reed do a definitive construction of Section 7703A1 for the word employee? An employee has a right to make this kind of appeal. And then concluded there that that has to be an individual because the statute itself defines employee to be an individual.
Well, I think most notably in Reed is that Reed drew a distinction between the MSPB and a negotiated procedure. And in Reed, it says that only the union may act as a representative when somebody chooses the negotiated grievance procedure. So we disagree that Reed forecloses the door on that. There have been other cases where the union has been granted standing to appeal an MSPB decision on behalf of employees. But again, that's apples and oranges. The issue before, I think, the court here is the negotiated grievance procedure. And the negotiated grievance procedure, the grievance doesn't have any stake in that. And the parties to a negotiated grievance procedure are the agency and the union. The grievance has no right to elect to pick arbitration on their own. They can't appeal, they can't seek attorney fees, and they can't appeal it to the Federal Labor Relations Authority. So just like the court said—
Are you suggesting that Ms. Kidwell could not have appealed this denial of attorney's fees?
Yes, Ms. Kidwell didn't pay for any attorney fees. The union—
So are you saying that Ms. Kidwell wasn't harmed by the denial of the attorney's fees?
I say the union was harmed.
But Ms. Kidwell was not.
Ms. Kidwell personally was not harmed by denial of attorney fees.
So then how do you have associational standing? Because associational standing requires that at least one individual member have the right to...
I think we would have associational standing because she is injured as a member of the union. So yeah, technically, yeah, she is injured. Because she is
She's injured because all members of the union are injured?
Correct. Because if the union is not allowed to appeal a decision of a denial of attorney fees, then why would the union ever pay the freight for people in their cases? The union is allowed, and only the union can appeal a decision of attorney fees to the FLRA when it's 14 days or less. And we would argue that the same logic should be employed when it's above that. It simply doesn't make any sense otherwise.
What I just don't understand is how could this court write an opinion saying that the union here does have the right to make this appeal in the face of what this court has already said in Reed and Senior Executives Association and Tierney, where we plainly, continually, repeatedly said that the term employee, as that's understood in 7703A1, is referring to the individual, the actual employee, and not someone else, not a union or not an attorney representing the union.
Well, I think if you look at the statute, which is what the government kind of hung their hat on here, where it says employee or applicant, I think this court is well within its bounds, if we get to the nitty-gritty of it, to simply rule that as having an absurd result, which is what happens if you follow that to its logical conclusion. Because you're right, if you take that literally and you say only an employer applicant, then no labor union should ever appeal to this court a denial of attorney fees. Across the country, it's done. We could appeal things to the MSPB, we could appeal things to the FLRA, but we could never seek judicial review of those attorney fees unless we just put her name as a petitioner.
You're saying we should legislate, rewrite the statute.
No, Your Honor, I'm not saying you should legislate. What I'm saying is that you know, I do believe associational standing could be found in this case, and it has been before. It's not a new thing. And if you look at the NTEU case, the NTEU versus Merit Petition Protection Board, that's what the court held. They kind of dealt with this. Who's the proper party here? And they simply said, you know, to allow the union to seek MSPB review and then not allow them to seek judicial review would serve no useful purpose. It says it would merely force NTU to bring an appeal in the names of one of its four members and not its own name, which doesn't serve a useful purpose.
Are you talking about the D.C. Circuit case from 1984?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. But didn't we already discuss that and distinguish it in Reed as well as Senior Executives Association?
I don't believe so. I think Reed draws a distinction between.
At the very end of the Reed opinion, doesn't this court do a discussion of that NTEU opinion from the D.C. Circuit and explain that the statute had been subsequently amended, and so therefore whatever the D.C. Circuit did in 1984 is actually inapplicable to the relevant statute that was before the Federal Circuit in Reed. And then we reiterated that same point in Senior Executives Association.
Yep.
Am I misremembering that?
Yes. Well, the way I read Reed is it draws a distinction, Your Honor. And
I'm sorry?
The way we read it is it draws a distinction between it. And, you know, irrespective of that, I do believe associational standing is found here. I believe all the elements of that are met in this case.
Putting aside the right to appeal, on the merits, 7701G1 says the board may require payment of reasonable attorney fees incurred by an employee. You said already that the employee didn't incur any fees here.
Well, the union incurred the fees that were paid for on behalf of their members.
That's different. The union is set up to provide services for its employees, for its members, one of which apparently is representing them in grievance proceedings.
Absolutely, which is why we believe we have associational standing. And that's kind of where we're at with that. We think that we have associational standing, and we think we should be allowed to pursue it. And in fact, the only case cited by the government in this case was that had to do with attorney fees, was a case that went forward. They point out that it wasn't, you know, standing wasn't challenged in that case, but clearly the court could have raised the issue and they did not. So that case was allowed to go forward. So this isn't like a totally new issue, but we believe we do have standing.
Well, you say it's not a totally new issue, but I think somewhere it's stated here, it's a question of first impression. You don't have a case that holds that the union may appeal.
Yes, and I don't believe we have one that says it can't. I think that it's kind of been skated around and never been fully determined. Again, we're talking about an arbitration proceeding, not an MSPB proceeding. So we feel it's differently, and a few things are set up differently. So that's why we're drawing that distinction, and we believe that the case law draws the distinction. So that's where we're at with that. With respect to the underlying issue in this case, this entire case involved a grievant who it was alleged that she gave a particular claimant personally identifiable information to somebody that wasn't entitled to receive it. The grievant alleged the entire time that the claimant did give her permission. Well, management in this case, instead of actually calling this claimant to determine that, they just referred the case to OIG. And then they proceeded to indefinitely suspend her for 14 months without pay. Well, at the hearing, we had the claimant show up who has said, yes, I did in fact give her permission. After hearing this case, the arbitrator ruled that the agency did not have the reasonable cause as required by the CBA law to sustain the decision to indefinitely suspend her.
Counselor, what's the... What's the posture of those investigations? Have any of them been finalized?
It was immediately dismissed by OIG as soon as the arbitration was over. So that ended. The arbitrator also found that the agency engaged in disparate treatment against their own past practices.
Mr. Harris, are you saying there was never a criminal indictment?
Never.
Okay.
There was never a warrant, never a criminal indictment, nothing. When the union made a motion for attorney fees, the arbitrator completely reversed his decision in a two-page decision and said, well, what I meant was, and I quote this, that the agency's action was neither prohibited by law, contract provision, or was without merit. That's completely not true. The arbitrator determined in his first decision that they violated the contract, and law, they engaged in bias and disparate treatment. When we filed the motion for attorney fees, he says, oh, they didn't violate the contract. I mean, it's just a completely ridiculous decision. The case law is secure on the fact that when an agency engages in disparate treatment and they indefinitely suspend somebody without the required reasonable cause,
Counselor, the record to me, I find very troubling, and the posture of the case and the decision in the situation of the attorney's fees, the reasonable cause analysis, all of that. You're running out of time, and I'd like to hear from you, how do we get around Reed? How do we get around the fact that the statute says that has a word employee, and obviously we have precedent that says an association is not an employee.
I think you get around Reed easily by simply saying that the union has associational standing, which is, it does. And this is what unions do. They advocate for their members. They litigate on behalf of their members. You know, that employee doesn't have to be here. She's long gone. We don't even know where that employee is. But the union paid the freight for her arbitration, and that's what unions do. So the union clearly has associational standing. This is absolutely germane to what unions do. It's the bedrock of what unions do, is represent on behalf of their members. And associational standing can be granted, and it has been granted in the past. And yes,
you said that's what unions do, and that's why they collect union dues, to pay for things like this.
They do. And unions should have the right to file an appeal when they feel that they've been unjustly denied those dues.
Are you saying that even if a party has standing, constitutional standing in some form or another, including associational standing, Congress has no authority to confine the pool of people who might have constitutional standing and restrict it to a certain subset? Like, let's say, for example, that is what the court concludes, that maybe there are a number of people or organizations that could argue they were harmed by a certain agency action. But then Congress chooses to pick a certain subset of that pool of people who actually have a right to judicial review. Are you saying that that's somehow unconstitutional for Congress to do that?
I don't think it's unconstitutional for Congress to limit the pool of people appeal, but I also believe that the associational standing is well established, and it's been used in this court and other courts for this very purpose. So you know, I think it's there. I think clearly the union has associational standing to pursue the interests of its members. So that's where I'm at with that.
Counsel, you elected not to save time for rebuttal, and in fact, you've just about used all your time, so there will be no rebuttal. We'll hold you to this decision, but do you have a final thought?
Just that we just want this wrong righted, Your Honor. We believe that this whatever decision you make here is going to have far-reaching tentacles across the country, and we would just ask that carefully consider the fact that that the arbitration procedure is strikingly different than the Merit System Protection Board procedures, and that only the union can push an arbitration forward, and the grievance is not a party to it. And we would just ask that you grant the union associational standing to try to pursue these perceived wrongs when they come up.
Thank you, Mr. Harris.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Carson.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The court should dismiss the union's petition because the union does not have standing under 5 U.S.C. section 7703A1 because it's neither an employee nor an applicant for employment as the statute requires. If the court does consider the merits of the petition, however, the court should uphold the arbitrator's denial of attorney's fees because the arbitrator's decision was not arbitrary, capricious, an abuse of discretion, or unsupported by substantial evidence. With respect to standing, as the court's already acknowledged, the Reed decision and some decisions that follow have held that 7703A1 clearly and unambiguously uses the term employee, which does not encompass labor organizations.
But can an employee invoke arbitration in this case?
I'm sorry,
can an employee on their own invoke the arbitration?
The employee needs to invoke arbitration through the CBA.
21 says that only an association can invoke arbitration.
Correct. So the employee invoked arbitration through the collective bargaining agreement, the grievance process through the CBA. That's correct. Notwithstanding that, once an arbitrator has issued his or her decision, 7703A1 controls who can file the petition to this court. We're not arguing that an arbitrator's decision can't be appealed to this court, obviously. We're simply saying that the proper party to appeal that decision is the employee, him or herself.
Let me go back to the question then. Let me make sure we're clear. Under 7121, only a union can invoke the arbitration process. Is that correct?
That's my understanding, yes, Your Honor.
So isn't it absurd that the statute would say that only an employee can seek fees?
I don't think it's an absurdity, Your Honor. Again, even at the arbitration phase, even though the employee has invoked arbitration and the union then, because it's the collective bargaining agreement, moves forward, the union is still moving forward on behalf of the employee. The employee, I believe opposing counsel say that the employee, Ms. Kidwell, doesn't have a stake in the process. Of course she has a stake in the process. And this whole the whole case originates from her being indefinitely suspended by the agency. So she has a clear interest and stake in the process. And the attorney fee award issue is simply derivative. It's derived from the employment action that the agency took against her.
Does the government think that Ms. Kidwell herself could have appealed the denial of attorney's fees?
Ms. Kidwell could have and should have appealed decision on the attorney fees.
She didn't pay the attorney fees, did she?
No, and quite frankly, Your Honor,
That'd be a standing issue on its own.
Well, first, Your Honor, I don't think there's any evidence in the record that anybody has paid any attorney's fees in this case so far. I don't think there's any evidence that the union has paid any attorney's fees.
That's not required under the statute, though.
I understand, Your Honor. But I think the point being, though, that 7703A1 establishes that it's unequivocal that the employee is the proper party to file a petition in this court. And the party and the employee, even if she isn't paying the attorney's fees, is still an interested party to the case. The case that we cite in
would have had to have been brought by Ms. Tidwell. Otherwise, there's no attorney's fees available under 7703.
Yes, that's correct. This isn't unprecedented.
And she's a member of the union.
She's a member of the union.
Why is that not associational standing?
Well, because of the prudential limitations on associational standing. That's what Reed.
Then why do we have the statute to begin with? If there's no opportunity, no ability to obtain attorney's fees in these instances.
It's Ms. Kidwell. So the award of attorney's fees.
Wouldn't you say that interpreting the statute in that manner just leads us to an absurd result?
I don't think so, Your Honor. The way that the statutes are to be interpreted and applied are that an award of attorney's fees is made to a plaintiff, or here the employee, and then whatever arrangement is made between the employee or a plaintiff and their attorney in regards to the payment of those fees or how those fees are to be apportioned is between the plaintiff and her lawyer.
Counsel, is it in the record whether the union argued the case, brought the case through its employed in-house lawyers rather than paying attorney fees to outside counsel?
I don't believe Mr. Harris is a staff attorney, Your Honor, and I don't know if you're alluding to the Rainey decision, which we cite in I believe it's footnote 4 of our brief, is an example of where an employee and a member of the union filed a petition before this court, part of which was appealing an arbitrator's decision denying a fee award. That employee, Rainey, filed that petition in his own name, but did not pay any attorney's fees. In that case, a union staff attorney, represented the employee before the arbitrator, and the fees were going to be paid into a fund, a union fund that would then be used to pay attorney's fees generally. And that's an example of an employee filing petition in their own name in a similar situation. This is simply following this court's decision in Reed and Executive Association interpreting 7703A1 and applying its clear and unambiguous terms. Again, we're not arguing that Ms. Kidwell could not have appealed this award, that the attorney's fee denial of an attorney's fee award is not appealable. We're saying that it is. It's just they have the wrong petitioner here.
Well, 7703 refers to a decision of the MSPB, not an arbitrator. And if we're interpreting employee literally, do we not interpret MSPB literally, not to include an arbitrator?
Well, I believe with respect to that, we have to go back to Section 5 U.S.C. Section 7121, which states that, in matters covered under Sections 4303 and 7512 of this title, 7512 being the relevant section, as it relates to suspensions for more than 14 days, which have been raised under the negotiated grievance procedure in accordance with this section, Section 7703 of this title pertaining to judicial review shall apply to the award of an arbitrator in the same manner and under the same conditions as if the matter had been decided by the board. So,
and you would probably also argue that Reed sort of covered over any ambiguity on that point because Reed dealt with an arbitrator's decision. Did it not?
Yes, Your Honor. If I understand your question, yes, Your Honor. And again, I know that that petitioner's counsel has argued that that association standing exists, but to the extent that it does, I'm not clear that it does. But even if it does, our prudential. When I say association standing exists, there are the three elements that the court has established regarding association standing. But as the Reed court pointed out, there are still prudential limitations on that association standing, and that's what 7703A1 places.
Let me correct part of my question, which misled you. I was incorrect factually. Reed came from the MSPB.
Yes, Your Honor.
Tierney came from an arbitration proceeding, right?
Tierney did come from an arbitrator's decision. Tierney involved, an individual lawyer filing. But again, I think Reed, I always get the name of the second case wrong, Senior Executives Association and Tierney all stand for the same exact proposition. And as you pointed out, they rejected the court's, the D.C. Circuit analysis in the NTEU decision, which petitioner's counsel relies upon. But even if this court were to find that the petitioner has standing, which we obviously don't think that petitioner does, with respect to the merits, an arbitrator has considerable discretion in determining whether an award of attorney's fees is warranted in the interest of justice. And here, the arbitrator correctly decided that while grievant prevailed on the merits, that the award of attorney's fees was not in the interest of justice. The record does not show that the agency made its decision negligently or in disregard of any relevant facts. The arbitrator found that the agency did not commit any procedural or administrative error, and the agency did not commit any prohibited personnel practice.
Almost all the reasons that were cited as to her removal or her suspension by the agency, they were overruled in arbitration.
Well, I don't think that.
There's no question here who the prevailing party was.
That's correct, Your Honor. But I think then the analysis that in petitioner challenges the attorney fees award on I believe three of the five Allen factors.
Didn't the Inspector General find that there's some sort of animus against her?
I don't recall. I believe the arbitrator's merits decision alluded to that because her father was as an administrative law judge was disbarred and convicted of himself misusing PII, and that she was being investigated for improperly accessing PII and potentially distributing or giving it to her father, the arbitrator commented in his decision that. May have colored the analysis that was conducted.
I said the Inspector General, I meant the arbitrator, found that the administration was consciously biased against her. Those were the words that they used.
Well, like I just said, Your Honor, I think it was based on those facts that she was improperly accessing and distributing PII and was doing so to her father who had been convicted and disbarred because of his misuse of PII. But regardless.
You keep bringing that up, but she was never charged with a crime. I'm not talking about the father.
I understand, Your Honor.
She's never charged with a crime. She was not indicted.
My understanding is that the investigation was was concluded and prosecution was not pursued because I don't believe this is in the record, but my understanding is that prosecution was not pursued because they had a difficult time proving financial harm to the individuals whose PII was improperly accessed and distributed.
Not filed. I mean, she's not indicted. She's not found guilty. I mean, we still believe in you're innocent until proven guilty, right? But it
correct.
Seems to me that your argument in your brief and what we heard it by the arbitrator, it almost stands that very serious principle on its head.
Well, Your Honor, I wouldn't go that far in that. I think that the case law establishes that a suspension can be appropriate based on an investigation. There's no bright line in that analysis.
It turned out the investigation was wrong. She was reinstated, back pay, the whole bit. I mean, if anything, they and not to throw another cliche in here, but it looks like they put the cart before the horse.
Well, I think that's usually the analysis in these cases is based on an investigation, and I think that effectively, Your
Honor.
That's
good when later on the investigation proves out to be true, but it's not good. It's not good to put the cart before the horse when the investigation turns out that we're not going to charge or we're not going to pursue the investigation.
And to that very point, Your Honor, that's effectively, though, what I think the arbitrator concluded, but in the sense that, you know, that the agency in this case acted based on an interim investigation report rather than a final report. And the arbitrator concluded that in his merits decision that they essentially they didn't act based on the practice, their practice up to that point, which was waiting until a final decision. However,
you don't call that putting the cart before the horse?
Well, here's an important point, Your Honor, and that is the analysis has to take into account the alleged conduct and the mission and of the agency. And here we're dealing with the Social Security Administration, and we have an employee that's not just alleged, but based on an interim report by the OIG, which the OIG does not normally issue interim reports and provide interim briefings, but because of the seriousness of the alleged conduct and the agency involved, and the inappropriate accessing of and distributing PII at the Social Security Administration, that there was there was concern, appropriately so.
And the arbitrator found there was sufficient evidence to conclude the grievant likely violated the agency's policies.
Well, in the sense, Your Honor, of and I think again, this was the arbitrator's decision. He said that essentially the SSA's disciplinary decision was premature, meaning that they should have waited until the end of the investigation. That doing so on an interim report of an investigation, it deviated from their normal practices and procedures.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. We will take the case under submission.
Thank you.